as far as I'm concerned, the beast is still very much alive today after 1,500 years, going back to the first ever story with St. Columba and his water monster in the River Ness.
Ladies and gentlemen!
Controversy continues to this day. The bottom line is, we still haven't managed to convince any zoologist, any museum, or any laboratory that there's something there. It's basically down like Bigfoot, like UFOs. It's down to a hardcore of dedicated believers, hunters, adventurers, if you like. It touches something in the psyche. Man's impressed by things bigger than himself. And the Loch Ness Monster fits that genre.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
What is going on, my friends? This is Tim Banal of banalofamerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 7. Big thanks to all the folks out there who tuned in for the Season 7 premiere and helped spread the word that BOA Audio is back. You guys are awesome. Trust me, folks, the ride has only just begun. Very excited about this edition of the program because over the years, as many of you know, we have explored many different cryptids on the show, but the creature that we are going to examine here on the program this week has thus far eluded us. It has only sort of been discussed tangentially, and finally we're going to put the microscope square on this iconic mystery. I'm talking about, of course, the infamous Loch Ness Monster, and we are going to look at Nessie in depth with our guest, Roland Watson, author of the book, The Water Horses of Loch Ness. And making this conversation with Roland even more amazing, he is coming to us direct from Edinburgh, Scotland, just a few short hours away from the Loch Ness Monster's proverbial stomping grounds at Loch Ness. It would be nearly impossible for me to give you the full rundown on this marathon conversation because we are covering Nessie from a myriad of angles. But let me just give you some of the tent poles of the interview. We're going to learn about the evolution of the Loch Ness Monster in mainstream popularity. We're going to find out about the many, many ways that monster hunters have tried to prove its existence over the years. We'll learn about the controversial surgeon's photo, which I'm sure many of you have seen, that allegedly shows the creature. We'll talk about the various theories surrounding what Nessie might be, including the paranormal Nessie theory and the concept that Nessie is a remnant dinosaur. Given that Roland has been studying the Loch Ness Monster for a very long time and visited Loch Ness numerous times, we'll speculate on what the best way would be to hunt the monster, and we'll also find out about how the locals at Loch Ness feel about the mystery after all these years. Plus, of course, tons and tons more. This truly is a jam-packed and comprehensive conversation with a researcher who has both chronicled Nessie lore and helped keep the mystery of the monster alive and kicking in this new millennium. I'm talking about Roland Watson, the man behind the book, The Water Horses of Loch Ness. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Roland Watson, allow me to provide you with a little background on him. Roland Watson lives a four-hour drive from Loch Ness in Edinburgh, Scotland. By day, he works in software engineering and holds a Bachelor of Science degree in astronomy. He has been interested in the Loch Ness Monster and mysteries in general since he was a boy, and has never ceased to believe that there is something big and mysterious in Scotland's largest lake. Therefore, outside of work and family commitments, he seeks to apply critical thinking to the Loch Ness mystery from the believer's point of view. Those thoughts, as well as his research in libraries and at the Loch Shore, are found at his blog, lochnessmystery.blogspot.com, and in his book, The Water Horses of Loch Ness. One more time, here is Roland's website, lochnessmystery, all one word, .blogspot.com. Check it out. And with all that said, my friends, let's get down to business and rock and roll. This interview was recorded on March 19th, 2012, Roland Watson, talking about the Loch Ness Monster on BOA Audio Season 7. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 7. Very excited about this edition of the program. It's amazing we've done 7 years of this show and have yet to really do a focused episode on specifically the Loch Ness Monster, and that's what we're going to do here on the program this week. Very thrilling, very exciting for me. The Loch Ness Monster is, of course, a staple of the world of the paranormal, and as we've talked about on the program, really has had its ebbs and flows in popularity. It seems like it's bubbling up a little bit, no pun intended, in recent years, and maybe our guest here is a big part of that. He is Roland Watson, the author of the book, The Water Horses of Loch Ness, and he's the man behind the wildly popular blog, The Loch Ness Mystery, and you can find that at lochnessmystery.blogspot.com. And finally, we're going to dive into Loch Ness and really hunt down this monster and try and get some answers about this really iconic case in the world of the esoteric. So welcome to the program, Roland. It's going to be a very fun conversation, I'm sure.
Thanks, Tim. Glad to be here.
Well, we usually start out with, you know, the bio, the background. I find it particularly exciting, too, that not only are you a serious, hardcore Loch Ness Monster researcher and author, but you're right there in Scotland, which makes it even cooler because you can give us some real amazing first-hand perspective. But talk a little bit, you know, about the bio, the background. Who is Roland Watson? How'd you get interested in the Loch Ness Monster mystery?
Well, I am a Scotsman. I've been living, born and bred in Scotland. I'm a 4-hour drive from Loch Ness, as it turns out. I live in Edinburgh. I'm married with 2 kids, and I've been interested in Loch Ness Monster since I was a kid, basically. So we're going back to the 1970s, really, which is a pretty heady time for the Loch Ness Monster, so it's quite natural that dinosaur-loving kids like myself would kind of latch onto that subject. So I was quite heavily into it. I got all the books I could and studied the subject in depth, even as a kid. So I was a kind of nerdy kind of kid in those days. And that's kind of gone through the years because I'm by trade a software engineer. So I'm a kind of, I like to think of myself as a kind of logical, clear thinker.
Yeah.
And like to apply some critical thinking to the Loch Ness Monster. Now, to tell you something there, I was interested in the Loch Ness Monster. This went through the 1980s. Then I went through a bit of a dip. I concentrated on my career, my family, which is not too surprising. Mm-hmm. And I came out the other end of it with 2 kids that could look after themselves. These few years passed, and I took a look around me. I'd always believed there was something strange in Loch Ness. And I've come to this point that I looked around 2 years ago, and I saw what a pretty barren landscape in terms of that particular cryptid. And I thought, well, now's the time to kind of maybe kickstart a blog. Because I reckon I had a few things to say about this. And I was trying to kind of reclaim the Loch Ness Monster. It's my kind of mission statement, if you look at my blog.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been building up the articles and so on. And basically, that's where I find myself today.
Yeah, it's interesting how you point that out, because I've kind of noticed that too in recent years that, you know, the Loch Ness Monster, that was huge. You know, I was born in 79, so I missed the whole 70s paranormal boom, but even when I was growing up in the 80s and the 90s, you know, the Loch Ness Monster was one of the top, like, 5 paranormal mysteries out there, and it seems to have progressively gone further and further down that ranking over the years until, you know, recent times when it's, you know, sadly, it's kind of become almost an afterthought in a lot of ways. And thankfully, you're sort of bringing the interest back up into it.
Yeah, well, let me tell you, most of the leading spokesmen on the phenomenon are kind of, don't actually believe there's anything strange in the lock at all. It's a bit like going into a church and finding an atheist in the pulpit, if you know what I mean. So it's, I can quite understand why that situation has arisen, because we're in a kind of age of skepticism, but people are more questioning. They want better proof. So, I mean, going back to the 80s, people began to kind of stand back a bit and take a closer look at the ecology of the loch, take a look at some of the pictures. A few body blows came along the way, like, you know, the surgeon's photograph was exposed as a hoax. Things like that chipped away at belief at any kind of credence in Loch Ness Monster. So that's kind of backdrop we're against today, really.
Interesting. Yeah, it seems... Well, it's a truly unique mystery in the world of the paranormal, too, in the sense that, like, with Bigfoot, you kind of have to go and look for Bigfoot. With UFOs, you know, they come to you. They're not... You can't really go somewhere to find UFOs. But with Loch Ness, it's there. And you just, you know, you have to go there to find the mystery, in a sense. It's very different in a lot of ways from some of the other big stories in the paranormal.
Well, Loch Ness, 24 miles long, a mile wide, and about 750 foot deep, it is the lowest depth known so far. Trouble is, you see it yourself, that's a pretty small area compared to searching California for Bigfoot. And it's very small compared to the skies that the UFOs might, move about in. The Loch Ness is largely unexplored, in my opinion, because you basically jump into that loch and you'll find out that you're in a world of darkness after a few feet. Now, I liken it to, now people will say, well, Loch Ness, pretty small, surely you'll find something. Bigfoot, you've got the entire forest of California or whatever else that you think they might be walking about. But to tell you the truth, Loch Ness is what we call peat-stained water. You've got all these rivers washing in various matter into it, and it suspends in the loch, and you dive in, and it's pitch dark after 10 feet. I kind of liken it to trying to find Bigfoot at the dead of night in a thick fog.
Yeah.
You can't do it.
Exactly, yeah.
It's the same problem with Loch Ness. You can only really penetrate it with sonar, and even then, you've got your limitations there. So I would still class it as a largely unexplored area.
Interesting, yeah. Now, I guess it seems ridiculous because this is such a iconic case, but, you know, I kind of liken this program to sort of like the show of record, if you will. So I guess give us sort of like a thumbnail of the Loch Ness Monster's story. When did this come about? I know that your book, The Water Horses of Loch Ness, talks a lot about, you know, the pre sort of boom in Loch Ness interest and how this goes back much further with folklore stories and stuff like that. But I guess sort of give us sort of a thumbnail look on what is the Loch Ness Monster for people who are just discovering this program or maybe are listening to this 100 years in the future and wondering what exactly we're talking about.
Sure, I'd be glad to. Yeah, well, the Loch Ness Monster it basically hit the headlines in 1933. Now, during that time, it was a pretty unsettled time for the world. We're going through a Great Depression. There was wars were in the offing. And into this comes this story. About May 1933, a story was run in the local newspaper called the Inverness Courier, talking about a strange spectacle at Loch Ness. And it related the story how a couple, the Mackays, had seen a couple of humps and some kind of disturbance in the loch. Now, unusual story. And in fact, a similar story had run 3 years before 1930, but no one really picked up on it. So that kind of ran locally. It didn't really gather much momentum, though it kind of started, you know, an interest locally. And we had a few more stories running. But it wasn't big news at that point. But what really took it off was what we call the Spicers, a couple from London, who in August of 1933 were on a tour of Scotland. And they knew nothing about this new story.
Yeah.
And they basically were heading back down south. They were passing on the quieter side of the loch, around the area we call Doors Foyers, which are two villages. And later they were to say in the letter that sparked this all off, you know, we saw this thing, we saw something that we could, it was the closest thing we could describe to a prehistoric monster crossing the road in front of them. So this thing was not in the water, it was out of the water, crossing the road in front of them, about 200 yards in front of them. So they described it in those terms, some kind of 15 to 20 foot object jerking across the road, a writhing neck, in sight for just seconds, disappeared. Time they got to the clearing in the bracken, it was gone. So this was published locally, and the national newspapers and the international newspapers got a hold of this, and the thing just exploded. So it made the London newspapers, the US, and so on, and from there on it just took off. So we have basically 1933, 1934, people were flocking to the loch, trying to get a picture of this thing, trying to get the latest stories, because it was basically a good, it was a good type up for the newspapers.
Yeah, yeah. Became like an international sensation.
Yeah, there was a lot of bad news about it, and this, whether you believe in the monster or not, it made for good news. And this continues into the 1934. 1934 was a kind of blow-off year in terms of fever. And then things quietened down. We went into World War II. So the ports tapered off. And you would have thought at that point that was the end of the story. It was just a seasonal thing. We'd hear no more about it. But they were wrong, because back it comes in the 1950s. The sightings keep coming. And a local woman called Constance White collected all these reports and published a book called More Than a Legend. And this rekindled interest. And from that book, someone called Tim Dinsdale caught the spark. He headed up north in 1960. And he caught what many believe was the hump of the monster crossing the loch in 1960 on cinefilm. Again, the thing bursts wide open again worldwide. He gets prime time television. The thing just sweeps across the world again. The Loch Ness Monster is on a revival. And a lot of things sprung from that film. You had lots of expeditions heading north to Scotland. You had an organisation called the Loch Ness Phenomena Investigation Bureau being formed, which ran for 10 years looking for evidence. You had Robert Rhines and his sonar expeditions from America and the Academy of Applied Sciences heading over in the 70s. So again, we're kind of moving up to a peak of activity in the 70s. We had the underwater photographs and, you know, things really, again, and I must point out again, this is during another recession. Surprisingly, the oil shock stagflation in the 70s. Once again, we had a good story running here. Whether you believe it or not, that's just the way it happens. And then it tails off. We get into the 1980s. Things get a bit more sceptical. A lot of monster hunters become disaffected because they really thought they would have proven it by now. So some of them begin to write books against the monster. Some of them look for more naturalistic explanations. And things have kind of been quiet now for the last 20-odd years. Which brings us to today. The monster continues to be seen. I mean, my blog documents stories people tell me, or I'll pick up on newspapers as well. So, as far as I'm concerned, the beast is still very much alive today after 1,500 years, going back to the first ever story with St. Columba and his water monster in the River Ness.
So this thing, you kind of just touched on it there. This thing, it exploded into the public consciousness in a sense in 1933 and beyond, but the history of this actually goes back much further, back to 1500, as you say. So that's pretty remarkable. So it has quite a history that maybe people aren't aware of, right?
Yeah, it tends to get dismissed. I mean, a lot of Loch Ness researchers are kind of more focused on what people were seeing at that time, modern times, because the Highlands had their folklore. They had their traditions of water horses, kelpies, and water bulls, all these kind of aquatic, mythical beasts.
Mm-hmm.
Some would argue are just kind of the ancient equivalent of modern cryptids. Except these animals, or so-called animals, were kind of supernatural. They could speak, they could change shape, and they were basically man-eaters, a lot of them. So some would argue that obviously these are stories to keep children away from the waters so they don't drown or things like that. Fair enough, there's that aspect. But I take the view that there's a grain of truth in these kind of overtly embellished stories. The typical story is the horse is grazing by the wayside, beautifully adorned, bridled, waiting for a rider. The wayfarer comes along, sees an opportunity for rest, saddles himself on this horse, thinks he's ready to go home, but suddenly he realizes he's on a kelpie, and he can't get off the horse. He's like Velcro, super glued to this horse. The horse reveals his true identity and gallops off into the loch and plunges in to feast upon his victim. Now, that kind of story is all across the Highlands. So some people would argue that, every loch has a has a water horse tradition, so it's natural that Loch Ness should have one. And that is indeed the case. But my studies show that actually Loch Ness is the most mentioned loch in the literature of the time for having the reputation of having a kelpie in it.
Huh.
Others have it too, but Loch Ness stands out more than any other one, which I take to mean that there's a grain of truth. There's something there.
Right.
Which was propelling these stories.
Interesting. Yeah. It makes sense. If it keeps coming up in that. Now, forgive me, because I'm completely really unfamiliar with sort of the topography and geography of Scotland. Is Loch Ness sort of like the biggest of the lakes in Scotland, or is it sort of, in the middle, or is it, one of the smaller ones? Where does it sort of rank amongst the bodies of water over there?
Yeah, Loch Ness is the biggest body of fresh water in the whole of Britain.
Oh, wow.
There's nothing bigger in England, nothing bigger in Wales, Ireland, or Scotland. It's just huge. I can't remember off the top of my head, but it might be 800 million cubic meters of water. And they bring it, there's a statistic that's often trusted out here. I haven't actually verified it. They said you could fit the entire population of the world into Loch Ness more than once, and there'd still be room for maneuver.
Huh.
But it's just huge. I mean, 26 miles. If I was walking, it'd take me the whole of daylight to walk the length of Loch.
Yeah, well, it's a marathon, right? Practically a marathon.
Yeah, 26-mile marathon. I don't think I could do it in 2 hours, but I'm just saying it's huge. It's the biggest loch in Scotland. It's not the deepest. Only Loch Morar is deeper. But Loch Ness has the greatest average depth. So it's just the biggest thing in Britain.
Okay. Now,
and it's up there with the rest of Europe.
Now, you talked about, you mentioned the surgeon's photo earlier, and I'm sure that's the one that, pops into the mind of anyone when they hear about Loch Ness. It's sort of like the iconic photo of the Loch Ness Monster. I guess you could liken it to the Patterson film of the Loch Ness Monster, in the sense that it's like the first thing that people think about is that picture. So what's your analysis, I guess you could say, what's your take on that photo? Because it's been debated to death, and I have no idea really the lengths of how much this has been examined and stuff. So enlighten me as to how much credence people should be putting into that photo.
Probably not much, but
okay.
I see that with reservations. The photograph was taken in April 1934, reputedly by a Harley Street gynecologist, I think it was, or some kind of doctor called Kenneth Wilson. And he actually took two photographs. One is a classic swan-like pose. And the second photograph, which wasn't published till over 20 years later, shows this kind of head submerging under the water again. So that kind of stayed the iconic picture. In some sense, it's still the iconic picture. Yeah, I've got it on my blog, a kind of representation of it. And it stayed that way. It's inspired many to compel them in the search, as it were. Until we got to the 1990s there, where two guys, Alistair Boyd, David Martin, wrote this expose. Now, they'd basically given a lead by another Loch Ness expert called Adrian Shine, who found a clitton in which somebody made some kind of confession. That the thing was just a staged up, a fake. So they followed the money, as it were, and they found this guy called Christian Spurling, who by then was very old, and he confessed that they'd set up the hoax for revenge. Now, by revenge, I mean back in the 1930s, as I said, when this was big news, a chap called Marmaduke Wetherill was employed by the London paper, the Daily Mail, as a big game hunter to go up to Loch Ness and find out what was going on. So he went up to Loch Ness with his team, and one of the first things they found was they claimed they found footprints on the shoreline. And it actually turned out that they were staged. The zoological experts looked at these spoors and said, this looks like a hippopotamus. How can you have a hippopotamus at Loch Ness? So the thing was found out. People debated at the time whether Wetherill had anything to do with this. But it turns out later on that he did plant the spoors, the fake footprints, because one of his descendants produced this hippopotamus ashtray for the writers of the expose book. So he was sent home packing, tail between his legs, and he, according to Christian Spurling, our old man in the 90s, vowed revenge on the Daily Mail. And so he surreptitiously staged this fake photograph and sold it through a go-between, Kenneth Wilson, to sell it to the Mail. So they took it, and it was published, and it was a sensation. Now, the problem with all this story is that Marmaduke Wetherill, the next part of the plot was he was going to expose the Daily Mail, saying the photos are fake, to their worldwide embarrassment.
Yeah.
That never happened. So to this day, we can't quite figure out why the plot line never quite followed through to the Marmaduke Wetherill getting his revenge. So there's a few loose strings to this story. It's pretty airtight.
Interesting. But, okay.
There's unanswered questions, but by and large, people accept that it was a fake.
Wow. See, up until I was reading your blog earlier today and talking to you now, I had always sort of believed that picture was legit. So I'm stunned to find out that, you know, you do a Google search for Loch Ness Monster on the images, and that's the only one that comes up, like, over and over and over again. It's amazing that we're dealing with something that still resonates, and yet, as you say, it's a pretty airtight case.
There's a few things I'd like to follow up there, because nobody can quite explain the second photograph of this head submerging. That's not in the story, that's not in the plot line, so that's an unanswered question. The other unanswered question is, like I said, why didn't Wetherill follow through on his revenge and expose the Daily Mail? And thirdly, I've got to say that one of the authors, Alistair Boyd, was a firm believer in the Loch Ness Monster, because he had a sighting of a bat, big hump rising out of the water in the 70s in Urquhart Bay, and he tells us he could see the water running down his back. It was that clear to him. So he believes there's a monster there, but he's quite happy to write this book because he knew, even though people would see this as a negative, he still believed in a monster. So there's this positive and negatives here, and still some unanswered questions, in my opinion.
Right. Okay. So it's a pretty airtight case, but the jury's still out, if you will, to mix metaphors.
Yes. Some small leaks, but otherwise.
Yeah. I presume then there's a litany of actually, well, maybe not a litany, but a handful of good photographs of the creature. What would you point people in the direction to if they were wanted to actually see what is, you know, maybe the most promising photo of the cryptid?
Yeah. Well, I'd say the first photograph is the best one. That's why I give it high prominence on my website. It was taken in 1933 by a Hugh Gray. Now, he said he went for a walk after church on Sunday along the banks of the south side of the loch, and he said he saw this thing rise out of the water about 200 yards away, and it was thrashing about in the water and spray was going everywhere. He had his camera, so he took some plates. Only one came out, and that's called a Hugh Gray photograph. Now, when you look at it, it's kind of looks chaotic.
Yeah.
So you really got to look at it a bit closer. It's accepted as positive evidence. I think it's a creature. Other authors throughout the years. Some people have argued they can see a Labrador dog in it. But I think I've proved to my satisfaction, hopefully others, that that's just an optical illusion. Because the whole dog face is not there. The brain's just filling in the gaps. The main thing is that you can actually see the head of the monster on the right-hand side. Now, I didn't even notice this till a few months ago. And no one had even mentioned it in any of the books. And I had to go through old newspaper archives back to 1933 to actually find someone that said, there's actually a head that looks like a seal in this picture. Now, the reason no one had seen this head gawping at them was because the official photographs in the newspaper had been over-contrasted. They were too contrasty and the feature was lost. But there was another better contact print made from the negative called Heron Allen image, which gives you a clear view of what has actually been photographed. And if people go to my blog, I've put it up at the front page, they'll see this kind of fish-like head, mouth open, beady eye, looking at you. And that to me is one of the best proofs of the creature. We have other pictures. It's a picture by Adams that shows a kind of short-necked creature. Some people claim it's the fin of a dolphin, but I think I can prove otherwise. There's also the Peter McNabb photograph. That's the famous photograph. You get two humps going past the castle. That was taken in 1955. You get the Dinsdale film, which in my opinion is genuine. You have other things too. And we're going right through up to the modern day. There's been pictures published in the last 10 years which are even better, in my opinion, than these photographs. If people want to look them up, Roy Johnson and James Gray. That's Gray of an A. Now, people will claim that these are fakes, but I'm of a different opinion.
Yeah, it's interesting too. And the Loch Ness monster suffers also from the paradox of this sort of modern age, where you know people always say, "Well, there's so many extra cameras now with the camera phones and everything," but at the same time, photographic evidence is more highly scrutinized now than ever because of Photoshop and everything else. So it's such a difficult sort of problem to address in a way. You know, we should have a lot more photos, maybe we do, but then it's like people are inherently skeptical of photos in modern times. Sad, but confusing too.
Yeah, we kind of have an evidence impasse here.
Yeah.
Where Photoshop has arrived, computer graphics. Now, and you're being asked yourself, how will people be convinced? Now, the problem with Loch Ness is, sure, there's a lot of people go through it, but the loch's a mile wide. So if something pops up in the centre of the loch, it's about 800 yards away. And most people go around with their 3 or 4 megapixel cameras. I tell you the truth, these things are just not good enough to get the detail, to get the definitive proof.
Yeah.
And you get the webcams as well, which are trained in Loch Ness, and you're really not going to get anything better than a blob. So it's a bit like the monster has to come to you, basically. You can't go to it.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, it's really no different than any of these other mysteries, in a sense. We're dependent on the whim of the creature.
Yeah,
and luck.
Yeah, it depends on the nature of the beast.
Well, that's a good segue, I guess, to the question of what is the nature of the beast. I mean, it seems like there are so many theories on the Loch Ness monster. And you have a whole section on the website, dedicated to what is the Loch Ness monster. It's sort of like the ultimate mystery behind all this. Have you personally sort of come to an opinion or a favored theory, if you will, on what is lurking there in the loch?
Yeah, that's a good question there. I've gone through various phases. Like I said, going back to a kid, I was pretty much in the plesiosaur camp. Moved on a bit. I went through a paranormal phase, because I in general do believe in the paranormal, supernatural, though I wouldn't insist that must be the explanation for everything strange. So I went through that stage, that this thing is paranormal, and then I kind of stood back again a few years back and said, let's try and just kind of find a biological explanation for this thing. So, I mean, the standard explanations, you've got mammals, reptiles, amphibians, invertebrates, fish. Really, I think it's going to be one of those guys. Now, mammals, we can kind of, in my opinion anyway, discount. We kind of have the long neck seal or pinniped theory, which has been favoured by a lot of researchers. We can go back to cryptozoologists of decades past who have kind of taken the view that it's just a gigantic seal. It's got a long neck. But I kind of agree with people that say, well, if it was a mammal, we'd surely be seeing a lot more of it.
Right, because it would be coming up rare.
Yeah, I mean, animals like mammals have to come up for air. Now, they don't need to show a lot to take in some air through the nostrils. Evolution would dictate that you conserve your energy, and animals tend not to poke their heads out much. But yeah, you should see, it should expose itself a bit more. And mammals like to come on shore, they like to bask. I'm not saying that's mandatory for this creature, but they tend to do that. And we know the Loch Ness monster does come on land, but, it's a pretty rare event when it does. And I think it's a nocturnal creature anyway. So, which is why we don't see much of it. So I kind of discount mammals. Reptiles, amphibians, I'm more open to. The people say that reptiles, amphibians couldn't survive in Loch Ness because of the temperature. The Loch Ness is pretty unique. It maintains a constant temperature about 5 or 6 degrees Fahrenheit throughout the year. That's why it never freezes over. So, pretty cold. And as we know, reptiles, amphibians are what you call ectothermic, I think. They're cold-blooded.
Yeah.
So they're kind of reliant on their environment for their heat. And people have dismissed the reptile-amphibian theory on those grounds. It's too cold. But my take on this is I like to I like to just question everything people say.
Yeah.
Not because I'm a cynic, but because I just like to say, well, let's see how far we can take this. So, my basic question to reply to that is, well, how do the other reptiles in Scotland survive? How do the snakes in Scotland survive? How do the frogs and the newts and other amphibians survive in cold, cold, wintry Scotland? The answer is, they find a way. You know, we have this wonderful diversity of life. Life always seems to find a way. But critics would say, but not in the case of Loch Ness Monster. So we kind of have this scenario where I call it the straw plesiosaur. You may have this kind of straw man argument that says, okay, look, you've got this dinosaur thing. That couldn't possibly be it. There's not enough food. It's too cold, so on and so forth. So they get rid of the straw man, and people say, well, that's it then. It can't possibly exist. But I see otherwise. I mean, I think this thing could be a reptile or an amphibian. But I think, you know, the loch is cold, but animals survive. You know, in my back garden here, when I go gardening sometimes it says, when I have to do gardening, I'll dig about and I'll find frogs under the ground. I find lizards under the ground because these guys are hibernating. And they escape the cold by burrowing underground. And they try to get below the frost level. So these are reptiles. These are cold-blooded animals finding a way. And they survive the winter in Scotland. That's why we have reptiles and amphibians and other cold-blooded creatures. The Loch Ness Monster, I think, it could be an amphibian. Because I think this creature mainly lives underwater. It's a water breather and an air breather. Maybe like a lungfish.
Okay.
Maybe something like that. Something that can quite a home in the water, but whatever compels it to come out of the water, it has the capacity to either breathe through its skin, or it has rudimentary lungs, or it carries the water supply. It just does this. You basically got to look at the sighting reports, and you've got to kind of piece a kind of mosaic together. And people have come up with this kind of flippers, long neck, long tail, couple of humps, and a thick body. Looks pretty plesiosaur-like, I must admit. But there's other features to this creature which I think class it separate to anything we really know about. For example, where people talk about, they see the humps changing shape. So they report this creature, they see it, its long head and neck sticking out the water, it has two or three humps. And they look again, it's only one hump. They look again, it's only two humps. So people have speculated that the monster has some kind of buoyancy mechanism on its back, or is evidenced on its back, which aids buoyancy, because when the creature rises out of the water, it's actually quite buoyant. It exposes a lot of itself out of the water. And if you have these humps which are taking on, creating positive buoyancy, for whatever reason, I don't know, it just rises out of the water, it rises vertically, it sinks vertically. It's a really strange behaviour it's exhibiting.
Okay.
I think this creature is something unknown to science.
Like a previously undiscovered amphibian.
Yeah. Now, if we go back to 70s, one of the leading cryptozoologists was Roy Mackel. Now, Roy Mackel was a biologist at, I believe, University of Chicago. So he was a qualified scientist, and he took an interest in Loch Ness Monster. He later went on to Africa to look for another creature called the Mokele Mbembe.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote one of the seminal books on the monster called the Loch, the monsters of Loch Ness. He did a matrix of properties and properties of a creature, you know, physiological, morphological, and the candidate species. And he filled in all the boxes, and the creature that got the most ticks was an amphibian. A kind of modified amphibian that, you know, made to look like not less monster, but unknown to science. So I'm kind of in line with Roy Michael, certainly at this point of time. I mean, I could change my mind next week. Well, I think we're talking about an amphibian. If you look at the land sightings, which is a very interesting subclass of Loch Ness Monster, the witnesses often describe webbed feet, not flippers. So I think we're talking here, if you talk about webbed feet, you're maybe talking about an amphibian of some unknown classification.
Interesting. Now,
so land sightings give you the full expose, in my opinion.
Yeah, because then you get the full view of the creature. You get, you know, there's nothing hiding beneath the surface. So, the one theory that I had heard quite a bit in recent years was the giant eel theory. So, it sounds to me like you're not a big proponent of that one. So, I guess at least just dispel that one for me, so I can and put that away for my personal mental file, if you will.
Yeah, well, the giant eel, people postulate something which is maybe an eel. Now, your common eel, Anguilla, the European eel, they can grow quite large, 7-6 feet. More commonly, you get a few feet long and, you know, a couple inches thick. But the kind of eel we're talking about here, we're talking maybe 2 foot thick and about 30 foot long. Now, nobody's ever seen any such animal. Now, because it's an eel, then we're kind of more in the comfort zone of the credible. And actually, Roy Michael, in the Matrix classification I just talked about, the giant eel came in second. So he was certainly thought it was a possibility. So once again, we needed some modifications to make it Nessie-like.
Yeah.
So he proposed a good runner would be the thick bodied eel. So you'd have an eel which kind of had a thickened middle section, and then you'd have a kind of dorsal fin which could, if it was flopping over in a certain way, would look like humps. Now the problem with that theory is it doesn't really explain the thin long neck scenario of what we see. And if we go back to land sightings, what is described by witnesses looks far from eel-like. Some people have described long, thin animals, but generally it's a bulky body, a thick tail, and a long neck. So unless this giant eel can puff itself up like a pufferfish, for whatever reason, in other words, we're talking about a thick body that is mainly hollow, then we're not talking about a giant eel here at all, in my opinion.
Interesting.
We basically got to go with what the eyewitness sees.
Right, exactly.
You've got to avoid the sin of modifying the data to fit the theory.
Well,
the problem today is people are more interested than they are in the data. And that can often lead you astray. I'm quite prepared to, you know, question eyewitness data if it does lead to a rational explanation. But I don't want to go down the path where people are saying, for example, we must discount all land sightings if we want to propose that the animal is a giant sturgeon, for example.
Yeah.
Sturgeon don't go on land. So you're kind of sweeping away an entire subsection of raw data just to fit your theory into the fit the square peg into the circle hole. You've got to be careful of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, how prominent are these land sightings? Because I think I was only really familiar with that first one from the 1930s that you were talking about. I don't have it in front of me. The Spices, I think, is with the couple that you're talking about. How prominent, though, have these land sightings been?
They're pretty infrequent. They're going back to, we go back to the folklore. The Kelpie was always appeared on land to its victims. It was an in water and it was an out of water creature. Now, whether there was a kernel of truth in there, people saw this thing on the land and they embellished stories. There's a possibility, but we have about maybe 35 stories related to this creature being seen on land.
Wow, and that's pretty good.
But this is over the last 140 years. The oldest account we have, apart from the folklore, is about the 1870s. In the 1870s, we have a story where this governess and her kids were out for lunch, and they were up the top end of the loch, breathing. And so you see this huge grey thing lurching past them, swinging its head from side to side, this tiny head, long neck, grey elephant-like skin, waddling into the water. You know, you can kind of say that changed the day for them. And 1870s, and other people have been seeing things like that throughout the years. And actually the last land sighting was in 2009.
Oh, wow.
Somebody took a photograph. His name is Ian Monckton, if you want to check that out. He was heading back with his wife-to-be after a holiday near Loch Ness. It was 11 o'clock at night, he said, and he stopped by the water, and he just heard this crashing noise down below. At that point, the locks were high up. So he heard this crashing and splashing noise down below. And he looked down and he took a flash photograph with his mobile phone. And what came out was this thing. It looked like a roast chicken, actually. And we only have a zoomed-in photograph. I've been trying to find the uncropped version of it. But he said it sounded like a car was being thrown into the loch. And, okay. And we take this picture, and it shows something which is kind of brownish-looking, kind of smooth. It seems to have some kind of appendages to it, but it's kind of in semi-darkness. So once again, we're kind of in blob land here. People at the time thought, the experts thought it was an otter or something like that. So, I mean, things are still seen, and I've tried to contact Mr. Monckton. If he hears this message, please contact me. But people are still seeing things. Land sightings still continue. Now, I think there's a possible avenue of a research here. Now, because what is the definitive proof of this creature? Now, apart from a carcass or a piece of DNA, I think you really got to grab this thing on, capture a photograph of it on the land.
Yeah.
Now since we have 33 sightings over 130 years, we're talking about once every 8 years, every few years, shall we say. Pretty infrequent, so you can't really just drive up to Loch Ness and expect to capture a view in your first sighting. And the other thing is, these creatures are nocturnal. Because I did a talk on land sightings to a local group in January, and I looked at the data, and there was a proportionally higher view of land sightings at nighttime, which I thought was pretty creepy.
Yeah, makes you wonder what they're doing. You know, maybe that's when they go for fruit or something like that.
Yeah, well, the reason it may come in land is what drives a creature? Reproduction, resources, safety, who knows? But they tend to come out at night. It's kind of, it didn't surprise us, therefore, that people had legends about dark supernatural creatures coming out to get you at night time.
Yeah.
And my view is if we can cameras, trap cameras or something at strategic points, we could get somewhere with this. You may have to wait a long time, but it's worth it. I mean, a typical story from 1919, Jock Forbes was coming back from market on his pony and trap with his dad. It was about 11 o'clock at night. I think it was February. It was dark. They were going along the road, you know, just thinking about getting to bed and having a good night's sleep. Then suddenly the pony backs up. It refuses to go any further. And before they know it, they see this dark shape slithering across the road. And before long, they hear a splash in the loch. And Jock Forbes says his dad muttered something in Gaelic, moved on, and they never talked about it again. That's the kind of creature we're talking about.
Yeah.
It moves about in the dark. It's nocturnal. It lives in a twilight world of peat-stained water. It's just, I'm not saying it's morbid. I'm not saying it's kind of devilish. I'm just saying it's a creature of the dark.
It's creepy. Very creepy stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I was there. I go up to Loch Ness a few times a year. I'll be going up in a few weeks, actually. And I went up to do some nighttime photography, infrared. And I went to Doors Bay, which is at the top. And this is not a built-up area. There's no street lights. You get the odd car coming past you. You can see some lights in the distance, but basically there's no light. I went down to the bay, and I was kind of looking around me, making sure there's nothing dark and massive near me. There, because you do get a creepy feeling if you're on a beach on your own and you believe there's a 30-foot creature somewhere. There's no record of Nessie ever killed anyone, so I felt fairly comfortable, but there was a heightened sense of adrenaline, you know?
Yeah.
Which is part of the chase, it's part of the adventure. That kind of gives you a bit of a kick, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I take it you personally have never seen the creature at all?
No, I mean, I've seen things, but I don't want to be a kind of person that believes everything is Nessie.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I don't want to believe, you know, if you're a skeptic, that nothing could be Nessie. I've seen things which I think just have normal, perfectly rational explanations. I've seen large concentric ripples appearing out of nowhere. I said, okay, probably just a fish. I've seen fish leaping out of the water as if being chased by something, but nothing ever appeared. Because I was sitting by the shore last year, camcorder in hand, and I just saw these fish about 30 feet ahead of me just starting to jump out of the water, you know, leaping out of the water, and I thought, something's chasing them.
Yeah.
I just kind of sat there, camcorder on pause, ready to record, waiting for something to come out of the water. And nothing came out of the water, and I kind of stood down again. I think in that case, it was probably just a larger fish, like a trout or a salmon, chasing smaller fish. But you got to get a sense of the loch. You've got to get a feel for what goes on around it. Being to learn the things that can fool you and be able to distinguish the natural from what appears to be, you know, unnatural.
Exactly, yeah. Can't go out there like, as you said, applying everything to the Loch Ness Monster.
Ladies and gentlemen, our special guest speaker will provoke you. He will inspire you. He is Creed Bratton. Two eyes, two ears,
a chin, a mouth, 10 fingers, 2 nipples, a butt, 2 kneecaps, a penis. I have just described to you the Loch Ness Monster. And the reward for its capture? All the riches in Scotland. So I have one question. Why are you here?
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
I asked the three of you to be here because you are all deeply committed to charity work.
My Mary J. Blige Foundation is celebrating its 10th year of searching for the Loch Ness Monster.